Dimitri, when you look at Ukraine right now, we've seen that Victoria Nuland was visiting Kiev and talking with Zelensky. How did you find it?
Well, it was her goodbye tour. I don't think anybody's going to tolerate her presence any longer because her entire Kiev gambit, as it were, is a complete and horrible disaster. So she went back there at like a criminal visiting the scene of a crime. And what could she do? Well, she looked really bad, you know? She doesn't have a game anymore. I mean, what can she do? Make suggestions? Well, she's already made a lot of really awful suggestions. Can she make some more really awful suggestions? Well, she probably did. In any case, I think this was her goodbye tour. I think that we won't be seeing her anymore. Whoever the next administration is, whether there is one or not, I don't think Victoria Nuland has much of a political future. Her one the one reason that they kept her around is because they really don't have any Russia hands left. They really don't have anybody who knows anything about Russia left. They're either political zealots of some sort, or they're just people who are horribly out of date, Russian emigres that are basically trying to somehow psychologically compensate for the fact that they made the wrong decision to leave Russia. So there's really nobody there to guide the process of handling Russia. And so they kept her on, even though she's a disaster and everything she's done is a failure. But I don't think that's going to go on much longer.
The West's favorite figure in Ukraine is Zelensky or Zaluzhny, in your opinion?
Neither. They're both duds. They're done. Again, the whole project is a complete failure. Now, the difference between Zelensky and Zaluzhny is that Zelensky is just completely detached from reality. He still feels like the Ukraine could perhaps reconquer Crimea. You know, that's the sort of thinking that goes on in his head. He's basically in a world of his own. And Zaluzhny is much more down to earth. And his plan, ridiculous as it may sound, is basically kill off the rest of Ukrainian men while trying to slightly delay the Russians, because the story goes the Russians, once they're done with the Ukraine, they'll attack Europe. So Zaluzhny is trying to curry favor with Europe and the Americans, saying, look, we're doing our best to delay Russia, because once Russia is done with us, it will attack you. And so we're giving you time to prepare. So give us lots of money and lots more weapons, as if that's going to work. So what the Russians really have to do is, first of all, get rid of Zelensky. That's kind of what the Russian plan might be if I knew what it was, but I'm just guessing. Get rid of Zelensky because he's spent anyway. Zaluzhny is much more reasonable, and really all you have to do there is completely thwart his plan to delay Russia. Basically show that Russia proceeds at his own pace regardless of what he does or doesn't do, which is currently the fact. Over the past 5 days, Russia has reconquered about 100 square kilometers of former Ukrainian territory, which is about as much as it took all of the Ukraine to all of summer, 90 days, to reconquer at a cost of something like 90,000 lives. Whereas the Russian losses they're not negligible, but they're not significant. And so the Russians can really decimate the Ukrainians at the rate that they will consider optimal. And so Zaluzhny's game is our progress in delaying Russia depends on your charity. Doesn't really work.
There are rumors about moving the capital of Ukraine from Kiev to Lvov. How serious is that, in your opinion?
I think it's a stopgap. I think the final destination is Geneva, somewhere on the shores of Lake Geneva, in a nice little mansion, an emigre government. You know, I think that's the ultimate plan. But Lvov is a reasonable stopping place.
How do you see the changes that are happening right now in the United States? When you look at the Biden administration, they're not in a good shape when it comes to the conflict in Gaza, in Ukraine. He's losing a lot of voters.
If a war becomes unprofitable, they know it right away. Alarm bells go off in Washington. This war is unprofitable. Start working on the next war. Because there's always got to be a war, you know, the military industrial complex has to be fed. But the war has to be profitable. So is Israel profitable? Well, no. Maybe a war with Iran? No, we can't fight a war with Iran. Taiwan, would that be profitable? No. So they're really stuck. You know, they're grasping at straws. They can't figure out what the next profitable war is. But one thing that they have definitely figured out is that the war in the Ukraine is no longer profitable. And so the difference is, I think the Democrats and the Republicans deep down agree that this war is no longer profitable, because that's numbers and they can talk numbers. You know, they're good at that. They're businessmen, all of them, lawyers and businessmen, not military strategists by any stretch of the imagination. But basically, the difference between the Republicans and the Democrats is that the Democrats basically have one foot in the grave along with all those dead Ukrainians. They can't really shake Ukraine off that easily. You know, it's on them. They've been soiled. Whereas the Republicans can now claim that this is all a Democrat problem, sort of. You know, try to walk away from it and do the usual thing that they do is declare a victory. For instance, a type of victory might be, look, we've successfully relocalized, that's a fancy new word, relocalized the Ukraine in Kiev, I mean, in Lvov. See, it's a whole new country and it's going to somehow make payments on its debt, which is really very, very important because that's about money. And the Russians, they can have all of that terrible territory with the terrible people who live there. And we don't want to have anything to do with them because they're such a disappointment. They just don't understand democracy. So that would be a very reasonable sort of typical American exit strategy as far as the Ukraine is concerned. So basically, that's what the Republicans would want to do. They probably want to figure out a way to start talking to the Russians about it and figure out what the Russians would agree to take on as their responsibility. Because one of the things they don't want is the Russians basically folding their arms and saying, well, you broke it, you own it. You are suckers. Keep sending the Ukrainians money or they will start attacking you because they're armed well enough to attack you in all sorts of ways. Do you want your military bases in Europe attacked by some upset Ukrainians? Well, then give them some more money. And that would be a very reasonable Russian stance. An unreasonable Russian stance would be, okay, you want to leave? Fine, we'll just take over the entire place and start paying their keep, even though you're the one who broke it. The Russians aren't likely to do that. So a lot of haggling will have to go on. So the Russians will probably just take the entire Black Sea littoral completely. No questions asked. Just give it to us. It's ours. Okay, fine. Now let's haggle over the rest of it. And that will go on for quite a while, I believe.
If I were to mention the losers of this war in Ukraine, obviously the first loser gonna be Ukraine, and the second one would be Europe, especially Germany, because they've lost a lot in this war. When you look at the German defense minister talking about fighting Russia for decades, they're preparing to fight Russia for decades. How reasonable is this kind of mindset in your opinion?
Well, you know, one way to survive is to declare war on Russia and surrender immediately. And, You know, that's not a bad strategy. Countries have survived that way before. Some countries have switched sides many times. Look at Bulgaria. First they're on Hitler's side, then they're on Russia's side, then, you know, it just goes on like that. So if you're a good for nothing little country that can't make it on its own and nobody wants you, you make a menace of yourself and then quickly fold. You know, declare that, oh, I'm sorry, you know, we made a mistake. We're on your side now. Please feed us. Because that the please feed us thing is very important to Europe at this point. Look at Germany. Their industry is literally shutting down. They're laying off people in droves. You know, their manufacturing base is shrinking. They can't even make Volkswagens anymore. You know, there goes Hitler's legacy. He's the one who made Volkswagen, people's car. Look at other countries, like look at Finland. The whole country is on strike. You can't get anywhere by train or by bus in Finland. Schools are not functioning. Nothing is working there because basically they said, well, we can't, the government said, well, Russia is now the enemy. We're building a big fence. We're no longer letting Russian tourists in. So all of the tourist industry that we built for the Russians has to shut down, and it did shut down. We're no longer getting fuel from Russia, nuclear fuel or natural gas, or the very important wood waste, which kept Finland heated for a really long time. No more wood waste from Russia. Very good quality wood waste, kiln dried. So you need natural gas for that too. And so they're freezing. They're losing money. They have to work longer hours for less pay. They don't get as much sick leave. All kinds of little problems that are basically making their society very unhappy. And that's pretty far from the European center, but pretty close to Russia. And that's going to spread throughout Europe. Basically, the European people are going to be very unhappy because they've been deprived of the luxury of having Russia provide them with energy resources and raw materials at very reasonable prices. Now, the question is, will Russia ever want to supply them again? That's a very good question. Why would Russia want to supply them again? Is it reasonable behavior to do this flip-flopping? Now we're your enemy, now we're your friends. First we kill some of your people, and now we want to trade with you. I doubt that it'll go down that easily with the Russians at this point.
If not Russia, who can provide them with this natural gas and energy at the same level, at the same price that Russia was providing them?
Same level, maybe. Same price, definitely not, because there is no pipeline. The cheapest way to deliver natural gas is to pipe it. Basically, you take it from the well through a pipeline, through some relatively simple cleanup process, you know, get the nitrogen out, various other things, dry it, back into the pipeline through a bunch of compressors and to the customers, to the ultimate end user. The expensive way to do it is to deliver that gas to a terminal where it is turned into liquefied natural gas, which is a very energy intensive process. Keep it refrigerated while it's in transit, and then deliver it and regasify it, which is another energy intensive process. All of that requires a lot of technology and a lot of energy, and only about 2/3 of the energy of the natural gas relative to what's available from a pipeline reaches the end user. So a third of the energy is just lost. It may be 15%, but if you include the cost of technology and everything else, it's probably closer to a third. And then there is the fact that Russia can negotiate long-term agreements because it has wells that will continue to produce gas for the next half a century at more or less the same rate. So it's a very stable system. And basically they can just feed that pipeline at cost and still make money. And that's a very good deal for the Germans. That's what made Germany the powerhouse, industrial powerhouse of Europe. Whereas the Americans are on this in this drill baby drill kind of dilemma, you know, the Red Queen kind of you have to run faster and faster to stay in place problem with their fracked gas. Basically, they're drilling for oil because just drilling for gas just doesn't make enough money. So they're always drilling. There's some gas-directed drilling, but not much. Most of it is oil-directed drilling. They're drilling like mad. What comes out of those wells is mostly gas. Okay, so they try as best to plumb that gas, and deliver it to a terminal where it's liquefied. That costs them a lot of money. Those wells don't last long, so the plumbing is a huge burden, a huge cost to plumb all those fields, and they run out quickly. So those fracked wells are down by two-thirds within a year, some rough numbers, something like that. And the fracked oil seems to be on a plateau. The gains seem to be rather small, and it's taking more and more money to drill a well. So before, something like oil prices over $50 a barrel were enough to justify drilling. Now it's 70, 80, and next year it's going to be 120. And at some point, there won't be enough money in the world to continue drilling for their fracked oil and gas. And then it'll be game over rather suddenly. It won't take years and years. It'll take months rather than years. And right now, there's still plenty of gas having to do with the coronavirus pandemic, because at that point, there was a big drop in demand and undrilled, completed, drilled but not completed wells accumulated, over 1,000 of them. These wells were now completed and piped out. And the inventory of completed wells is rather small, so it's shrinking. So nobody knows what's going to happen once that's finished. So the whole thing with American fracked gas is rather precarious, I would say, and Europe shouldn't depend on it. As far as the Middle East, that's all very stable, you know, and I don't think those Gulf states are really eager to increase production for any reason. They're happy playing along with Russia and making sure that the prices are where they want them to be. As far as long-term agreements, they don't want to make long-term agreements with Europe, because Europe has kind of decided to play the market. Well, they're welcome to play the market somewhat. As far as long-term agreements, there's China.
Before this happening, Russia was in the middle of the West and the East. Right now, they're totally together. How do you see these changes that are happening, that we're witnessing right now?
Well, China really doesn't care about anything except China. It's always by itself. Now, the fact is that it has a really good relationship with Russia. Right now, there's a lot of haggling going on over pipelines going from Russia to China. And the haggling kind of goes like this. China says to Russia, well, who else are you going to sell this gas to? And Russia says, well, who else are you going to get this gas from? And it repeats in that pattern. You know, it's like, you know, they're knocking heads, and it's all about money. Like, who's going to pay for that pipeline, and how fat are we going to make it? And how quickly are we going to build it? And so everybody wants a good deal. The other thing that's happening between Russia and China is there are lots of students going back and forth, lots of tourists going back and forth. The Russians have discovered Hainan Island, which is their new kind of Disneyland. Direct flights, all that, easy visa requirements. So they love that. And St. Petersburg is just chock full of the Chinese again. They're just all over the place. And so that's another thing that's happening. As far as China standing behind Russia as far as the Ukraine, well, that's like China buying a lottery ticket and saying, we bought a lottery ticket, and we're keeping it. We're not throwing it away. And now China is saying, it's a winning lottery ticket, and we're going to cash it in. And that's really how as deep as it gets, I think. Basically, everybody knows that the Ukraine has lost, and Europe has lost, and the United States has lost in Ukraine, that Russia is winning, that Russia is in no hurry, neither is China. But now that it's completely obvious, China can get more dividends from saying it stands with Russia than by not saying. So that they're just calculating their own national interest. It has nothing to do with Russia per se. It's not like they're, you know, they're kissy huggy with the Kremlin. It's like, you know, it's a business relationship. Everything is business with the Chinese, and so it's good business. That's all it is. China and Russia are doing good business, and the politics are falling into place.
The other thing that China is thinking of, in my opinion, when you look at the situation in Taiwan, they know if they don't side with Russia, who can be their partner in this conflict between China and the United States?
Well, I think that it's this has mostly to do with geography. China doesn't really have to face off the United States on its own. It can call on Russia to do that, to help. And that's a really good thing for China. As far as Russia, you know, the Russian Far East is huge and borders the United States. It borders Alaska. So having China there to help is very helpful, because then Russia doesn't have to face the United States alone in the Far East. Russia doesn't have that much population. It's working on it, but it doesn't have that much population in the Far East. It's a relatively new part of the country, still being settled. And after the Soviet years, there was a period where it lost population. Now it's sort of trying to combat that. But having China there to help is very, very helpful. Very helpful. So it's synergy having to do with geography.
Recently, Japan and Germany signed a military pact aimed at containing China. When it comes to the relationship between China and Japan, what would China want from Japan? Are they afraid of China attacking them? Why they're doing this, in your opinion? What's the reason behind this?
Uncle Sam told them. There was a similar thing between Japan and South Korea. You know, Biden got their leaders to fly to Camp David near Washington. And it's sort of like they can't really decide anything themselves. But if the U.S. tells them, then they just do it. They sang karaoke and whatever else. If they were told to dance, they'd dance. So this is just a question of their American master saying, okay, you two now kiss. And so they kiss. What choice do they have? They don't like each other, but that's what they have to do. There's no love between South Korea and between Korea in general and Japan. None whatsoever. And yet this happened. Similarly, you know, joining up Germany and Japan brings back really bad memories. It's just the optics are awful. And so I don't think the Germans or the Japanese are actually dumb enough to go for it. And so the only reason they might go for it is, again, Uncle Sam telling them to kind of like, okay, hug and kiss. And so they do, because they have no choice. They have absolutely no ability to make their own decisions. And that's all that means. Basically, it's Washingtonians grasping at straws, knowing that they're losing their grip on the world, and trying to come up with some kind of a, you know, maybe here we try AUKUS, and here we try to join up South Korea and Japan, match made in hell, and here we're trying to join up Germany and Japan, another match made in hell. You know, what's next? I don't know. They're really running out of you know, defenseless little nations that they could somehow manage to team up. But this one is particularly funny because, you know, if you think about the optics of it, Germany and Japan, what are we Are we back to World War II now? You know, World War II reenactment? Is that what we're looking at? Except instead of Russia, we're doing it with China, world's largest economy. Is that a good idea? No, it's a very stupid idea. But and yet we're seeing it.
In the United States, they're talking about bombing Iran. How serious is this type of mindset, considering both parties, Republican and Democrats, when it comes to the blob, to the elites of the United States? How serious is this kind of mindset, in your opinion?
Well, it's serious in that it's ingrained. I mean, how many years ago was it that they wrote the song Bomb, 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 Bomb Iran? Long time ago. It's a, basically a takeoff on a 1950s doo-wop hit. That was a long time ago. And so they're always dreaming of bombing Iran, but they never can quite do it because Iran is not a country to be trifled with by any stretch of the imagination. And I think they've lost. I think they've already fought Iran and they've already lost. That general that Trump had assassinated, he established this crescent that used to be called the Shia Crescent of various insurgents all around Iran, as far north as Azerbaijan and as far south as Yemen. And all of those logistics have been sorted out. So now it's possible to load up a tractor trailer with rockets in Iran and drive it straight to Yemen through all the customs posts, because all of that has been arranged. Even Saudi Arabia, you know, which is not Shia, is okay with that happening, strangely enough. Even though they had certain disagreements with Yemen over the years, big ones, they're okay with this. And what it's turning out now is that the Shia Crescent is not Shia. It's also Sunni. It's also Marxist-Leninist. It's also all of those military types all over the place who went to military academies in Russia over the years. They're all very well trained, very well armed, and their ideology is the ideology of destroying the great Satan and the little Satan, which is Israel. That's really their point of agreement. And it doesn't matter what type of Islam or whether they're religious or not, they're all very much aligned and in agreement. And now they have a strategy. Basically, Iran doesn't have to lift a finger. They have all of these proxies. All they have to do is, you know, supply them, keep supplying them with rockets. And they'll keep lobbing those rockets at U.S. military bases in the region, killing Americans. What the Americans can do in response, since they can't do anything on the ground anymore, is basically lob some tomahawks, ineffectually, maybe killing some civilians, but we don't know, but not really doing any damage, because it's been proven that you can lob tomahawks at something for years and years and years, and not much happens. All of those rockets are in tunnels and dispersed, so they're very hard to get at. And the end result will be that the Americans will pull out of the region. So the only remaining question is, how long will it take them to realize that they've lost and to leave? And whether they'll still have enough money to repatriate all those troops and resettle them and get all that war material out of there, or whether there's going to be a few years after this gigantic military flea market in the region, where all of the weapons that the Americans will inevitably leave behind will be sold at various types of auctions. And, you know, that's how I see the future. But I don't see a war with Iran, because the Americans cannot keep their industry open, can't get all of those tractor trailers running on the interstates without oil from the Middle East, from the Persian Gulf. The Persian Gulf, half of it is Iran. If they start a war with Iran, what will happen to the tankers that are headed to the United States that allow them to continue making diesel and jet fuel. And what happens to the United States if there's a huge shortage of jet fuel and diesel? You know, that's enough for a revolution right there. So there won't be a war with Iran.
How much of this, in your opinion, comes from the Israeli lobby in the United States, or maybe come from the Netanyahu administration and his party, Likud party?
Well, right now, probably not very much, because I think Netanyahu is kind of in the doghouse as far as Washington is concerned, much as they dislike it. But he's such a bad bet at this point. He's toxic. So I don't think that he makes phone calls to Washington and asks them to please bomb Tehran. You know, I don't think that that's happening. I think what's happening is that there's a lot of almost cultural inertia now, where, okay, there's we have certain enemies. We have North Korea, but we can't touch them, because if we touch them, then we also touch Russia and China, and it's World War III. So cross that one out. There's Russia, but Russia is stronger than us militarily, and, you know, has all of these fancy hypersonic weapons. So we touch Russia, we're dead. We can't touch Russia either. China, well, we can talk about attacking China, but we completely depend on spare parts from China to keep our military industrial complex running. So no Chinese trade, no military industrial complex. Where do we go from there? So we can't touch China either. But can we touch Iran? Well, no, we can't either, because if we touch Iran, then we run out of diesel fuel and jet fuel, and our economy crashes and we can't fight wars anymore. But still, Iran is ingrained as, you know, the menace that we can still discuss. The others are just too ridiculous. But this one, we can still talk about it. And these senile congressmen and senators who've been in office for I don't know how many years, they remember very few things, like all of the countries that end in Stan. They don't mention them, because they don't know the difference between Turkmenistan and Kyrgyzstan. Forget it. But they remember Iran. They sometimes get Iran confused with Iraq, because they're sort of similar, but they do remember Iran, so they bring it up a lot.
The Netanyahu administration is agreeing on a ceasefire in Gaza. Do you see this as a force coming from the Biden administration, or they're not in a good shape in Gaza, that's why they're going along with this plan?
Well, the Gaza operation failed. Basically, they have realized that Hamas is not some little military group. It's the entire population that voted for Hamas. If they kill a Hamas member, another one pops up in his place. If you kill a Hamas commander, another commander pops up in his place. And that can go on forever. Meanwhile, what's going on there is genocide. Nobody likes Israel anymore. Israel is losing lots of money as a result of that. That is going to be a terrible problem for Israel. And the Israeli economy is cratering because of all the people who've been pulled into the military, and because of all of the logistical problems having to do with the Suez Canal and the Red Sea, and various additional problems having to do with countries no longer having anything to do with Israel because of pressure from their own Muslim populations and so on. So Israel is forced to try to do something different. Also, they're realizing that Gaza was a conflict that at least they could somehow hope to contain, but what's happening on the Lebanese border may not be so containable. And they've already surrendered a chunk of territory, which, you know, they had to just completely evacuate. They have lots of people, hundreds of thousands of people, who've been basically left kind of homeless, resettled temporarily. They have internal refugees now. They're having problems on the West Bank, where the Americans have started sanctioning Israeli settlers. So far, they've been afraid to touch the Israeli settlers who have American passports. That will be a Rubicon for them to cross. Once that happens, all bets are off on the entire Israeli settler West Bank thing. But basically, they're losing. The Israelis are not gaining ground. They're losing ground. They have not regained control of Gaza, really. They've just lost a lot of people and a lot of tanks. They have not regained, they're not even trying to regain control of the Lebanese border. And they're looking at a massive escalation from all of these little proxies, all of these little mosquito armies that they can't even identify. And that can go on forever until Israel is broke, until the Israelis have had enough, and most of them leave. And then you have a small, bankrupt, defenseless country. Who wants that? You know, Netanyahu thought that he could try this gambit in order to extend his political career and stay out of jail, but he might lose the country doing that. And I think that that realization will gradually sink in.
For 16 years, they were in power and they did nothing to solve this. Is the United States getting to the point that the Netanyahu administration and his party are not capable of doing that? Let's work on an alternative in Israel.
Well, first of all, the stance of the Israeli government of, you know, slaughter a few tens of thousands of civilians and then maybe talk. And then if that doesn't work, then go back to slaughtering more tens of thousands of civilians, maybe. That's not very polite, is it? I mean, I know a little bit about how Islamic countries generally work. It's pretty easy to make enemies. It's very hard to make friends. Once you make enemies, generally you have to either die or you have to pay blood money. Now, Israel doesn't have enough blood money to pay all of the Palestinians. So a lot of Israelis will have to die. You know, that's like the very simple kind of understanding the mindset kind of situation. So I don't think Hamas is all that eager to negotiate with people who've killed so many of their people. I think that that would be a dishonorable thing for them to do at this point, and honor is very important for them. And so revenge is probably what it's going to amount to for a very long time. Now, can the Israelis sustain that? I don't know. Now, the other thing is that you might say that, well, if we usher Netanyahu and his people and maybe even the whole of Likud out the door and get new people in, maybe that'll change something. Well, you have to understand that the vast majority of Israelis actually hate the Palestinians, don't consider them as human, and want them killed. So it's not like they're going to ever elect anyone reasonable. More likely, they're going to say, well, you know, the Palestinians are absolute beasts, but we can't win. So we're going to, I don't know, pick a place. Paris. We're going to Paris. And they'll pack their bags, they'll take a taxi to Ben Gurion Airport, and they'll fly out, never to come back. So that will probably be a pattern. Now, eventually, you will have this rump of a government, and it'll somehow have to retreat or surrender. Although with a tiny country like that, there's nowhere to retreat to. You know, usually the way things have ended up in Palestine before is the Jews end up in a citadel where they drink their own urine and eventually die. All of them. You know, so maybe it'll be a new Hadassah. Who knows? But it won't be nice. I don't see a nice political solution for Israel
recently Burkina Faso's interim president talked about how France was acting in his country for years, talking about fighting terrorism in Burkina Faso, and he said that they did nothing. On the other hand, by overthrowing Gaddafi in Libya, they increased the violence in that region. How do you see the position of the West, especially France, when it comes to this type of statements?
Well, a lot of these African countries have gained their independence to begin with thanks to the Soviet Union. And the Soviet Union, for most of its existence, supplied it with all kinds of things, you know, trucks, power stations, building schools and hospitals, helping with administrative problems, lots of medicine, inoculation programs, etc. Getting child mortality down from preventable diseases. All of that the Russians have been involved with. And then when the Soviet Union fell apart, the Russians went home because there was no money coming in. They couldn't stay there. They left. And then the Europeans started recolonizing these countries. And these countries had no choice but to let them in. France got control more or less of its old colonies back, reintroduced, started printing its own money with onerous strings attached, started various mining operations that the countries such as Niger did not benefit from much at all. All of that uranium that was mined in Niger just went to France. The Nigerians didn't get jobs, didn't get education, nothing. And so that's been the pattern of recolonization. But now Russia is back, and all of the Africans, it was already a few years ago, a couple of years ago, they all went to a big conference in Sochi, a Pan-African conference, where basically they expressed joy at the fact that Russia is back and is going to continue helping them. Because there's a huge difference between the Europeans and the Russians as far as the Africans are concerned. The Russians don't treat anything different from them. The Europeans, no matter what they say, treat Africans as an inferior race. That is so culturally ingrained that they can't do anything about it. And the Africans know that. The Russians, they go to Africa, they just basically go native. That's what the Russians do everywhere, you know, because Russia is so diverse, it has so many different groups. So, you know, Russian is a kind of like a name that applies to lots of different groups that nobody knows. They're separate ethnic groups outside of Russia. So outside of Russia, they're all Russians. Inside Russia, they're Yakut. Who knows what a Yakut is? Well, in Russia, people know. Outside of Russia, they don't. So they go to Africa and they sort of meld with the local population to a very large extent, whereas the Europeans build compounds behind barbed wire fences and security service, and that's how they prefer to live. So the Russians are very natural within that environment. The Europeans are not, and that change will be taking place. It's already taking place.
When you look at what's happening right now to Imran Khan in Pakistan, how do you see the reaction of the people in this country? How long does it take that they get to this boiling point and say enough is enough? We are not happy with these type of decisions that coming from outside of our country. We want something domestic. We want to decide about our destiny. Do you see this happening in Pakistan?
I really can't tell when the boiling point will come. I see that Pakistan is inundated with Western agents who are quite able to manipulate local politics in all sorts of ways. A few years ago, I was amazed to find that the CIA, for instance, can operate absolutely freely, can kill local people with no consequences, just basically get out of your car or your Jeep, shoot a Pakistani, get back in and drive off, and the local police do nothing. you know, that basically it's a sort of an occupied territory. So as the hand of London and Washington grows weaker, some Pakistanis might be able to be more assertive. Imran Khan has pretty much signed his own death warrant by going and talking to Putin pretty much on the day Putin announced the special military operation in the Ukraine. That was just unspeakably rude as far as the Western masters were concerned. So basically after that, he was in for it. You know, it was basically everything else that's been happening to them since then is retribution for that act of independence. And so that's very unfortunate for him, and it's unfortunate for Pakistan. But I don't think that there's going to be anything sudden happening there. You know, basically the Pakistanis are not really rebelling. They're not revolting. They're letting this happen. The legal system is functioning as if this was normal.